So imagine you're staring at a blank piece of paper, like a 15 by 11 inch piece of really thick 300 gram cotton watercolor paper.
Oh, that's the intimidating stuff.
Right. And your goal is to paint the vibrant, chaotic, just pulsating heart of a Colombian music festival.
That is a massive undertaking.
It really is. And convention dictates you need to be there, you know, in the thick of it. You need to be squinting into the sun, feeling the breeze.
Dodging the crowds.
Exactly, dodging the massive crowds and just absorbing the sheer energy of the plaza. But what if you aren't there? What if you were sitting thousands of miles away, isolated in a quiet studio in Whittier, California, just looking at a computer screen?
Yeah, I mean, it creates this massive physical and sensory disconnect, right?
Yeah.
You're essentially trying to bridge two entirely different realities.
Yeah, which feels wrong somehow.
But we're so accustomed to that romanticized narrative of the artist capturing the essence of a place by breathing its air, you know, replacing that physical immersion with a digital screen feels almost like, well, like artistic heresy.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Because for today's deep dive, our mission is to explore exactly how physical distance and digital screens influence the emotional and conceptual depth of cultural art.
Right.
And we are doing this through a really fascinating case study. It's a watercolor piece by Jairo Duque titled Sevilla on Bandola.
It's a gorgeous piece.
It is. It depicts a massive, lively festival in Sevilla, which is a municipality right in the heart of Colombia's coffee region. But as we mentioned, it was painted entirely from a web photograph while the artist was in that studio in California.
Yeah, and the central tension we really need to pull apart today is whether that reliance on a low resolution web photo and geographic distance
Yeah.
flattens the creative perspective. Like, does it limit the technical
Or
execution?
is there an upside?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Conversely, does that very exile act as a necessary filter? Does being far away strip out all the overwhelming noise of reality, allowing for a much deeper, almost nostalgic synthesis of one's home country?
Man, that's such a good question. But I want to pause on the physical workspace for a second. Because if he's looking at a monitor, he's not actually seeing the light of Colombia, is he?
No, not at all.
It seems like painting from a screen fundamentally alters the technical reality of a painting.
It absolutely alters the actual physics of the light the artist is consuming. I mean, think about it. When you are standing in a plaza in Colombia, you are experiencing subtractive light.
Subtractive light. Okay, break that down for me.
Right. So think about how human vision evolved. Photons from the sun hit a stone building or, say, a terracotta roof. The physical matter of that roof absorbs certain wavelengths of light.
Okay.
And whatever wavelengths aren't absorbed bounce off that surface and enter your eye. That light is organic. It literally carries the history and the texture of the material it just interacted with.
Oh, wow. But when you are sitting in a studio in Whittier staring at a computer monitor, you aren't seeing reflected light at all.
No, you're dealing with additive light.
Additive light, right, because you have millions of tiny diodes firing red, green, and blue pixels directly into your retinas.
Exactly.
The monitor isn't reflecting an environment, it's projecting a synthetic, mathematically calculated approximation of it.
Yeah, you are consuming artificial light that is attempting to mimic organic sunlight. So the screen is fundamentally altering the raw color data the artist's brain receives before a single brushstroke is even made.
Okay, so if the screen is literally feeding your brain the wrong color data through RGB light, how did Duke handle, the most important building in the painting?
The basilica, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at his depiction of the town's basilica, and he uses these incredibly warm ochres and yellows. He treats it as this massive symbolic anchor in the piece. I mean, the building is practically
It
glowing.
really does radiate this immense heat and presence.
But I have to push back on this a little bit. I have to question the authenticity of those warm
What do you
ochres.
mean?
Like, are those tones a true visceral response to the actual Colombian environment? Or, and hear me out, has the screen forced the artist to just default to a Latin American warm town color palette?
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it feels a bit like when you take a photo on your phone and the natural lighting is just a bit dull, so you slap a generic warm social media filter on it to make it look the way you think it should look.
That is such a good point.
Right?
What's fascinating here is that you're questioning the origin of the palette. Is it genuine memory or is it a digital crutch?
Right.
Because when you filter a regional architectural style through a web photo, you run a very real risk You might keep the skeletal structure of the scene, like the arches, the height of the towers, but you lose the capricious, subtle nuances of real light bouncing off aging stone.
Because the camera simplifies it.
Exactly. The light becomes standardized by the limitations of the camera sensor that took the photo, and then standardized again by the monitor displaying it.
And it's not just the light that gets standardized, right? It's the people.
Oh, absolutely.
The painting features this dense festival crowd. And if you look closely, the crowd is rendered using dots, spots, and what the artist's own notes refer to as rhythmic chromatic abstractions.
Yeah, and this is where the specific medium of watercolor collides violently with the reality of using a digital reference. Watercolor is just a relentless, unforgiving medium.
Wait, but watercolor has been used for centuries to paint highly detailed botanical illustrations, right? Yeah. Incredibly precise portraits. Why couldn't he just map out the crowd from the photo and take his time painting every individual person?
Because of the physics of the paper and the water. Duke is using 300-gram cotton paper.
Okay.
When you employ wet-on-wet watercolor techniques for a massive, sprawling crowd scene, the cotton fibers absorb the water rapidly. You essentially have a ticking clock of evaporation.
Oh, always say.
You have a window of mere minutes before the paper dries and locks the pigment permanently in place. You physically cannot sit there and noodle over a single face for an hour. You have to move with incredible speed.
And then combine that demand for speed with a standard web photo.
Right, a compressed JPG.
Yeah, when you zoom in on a JPG to try and see the people in the crowd, the image degrades immediately. It pixelates into blocks of color.
Becomes a blurry mess.
Right. You physically cannot tell if a dark, blurry blob is the brim of a peasant's hat, the shadow of a street pole, or like a bird flying by.
Exactly. So the abstraction isn't just a stylistic choice, you know? It's a technical mandate born from the limitations of the digital file and the drying time of the paper.
Which is kind of tragic, honestly.
Well, it raises an important question about what is fundamentally lost in that abstraction. Because Duke explicitly states his intention with this piece is to reflect a social commitment to the peasantry, to honor the dignity of the agricultural worker.
But historically, in visual art, human dignity is often anchored in the particular. You find dignity in the calloused hands, the specific tension of a weary shoulder, the deep crease of a weathered face.
And you just cannot see calloused hands on a computer monitor from a compressed image file taken 50 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
You're forced to treat the crowd as an anonymized mass.
You lose that direct individual human force.
Right. The geographic limitation forces a technical shortcut that directly challenges the artist's stated social intent.
And that limitation extends beyond the people in the plaza all the way to the background, right? The mountains surrounding the town.
Ah, yes. The atmospheric perspective, or rather the lack thereof, this is perhaps the most critical technical toll of the screen.
How so?
Well, in the real world, as objects recede into the distance, the atmosphere between your eye and those mountains isn't empty space. It is filled with dust, water vapor, and gas molecules.
Okay, sure. But how does that actually change what we see?
It's a phenomenon called Rayleigh scattering.
Rayleigh scattering.
Yeah. These particles in the air scatter short wavelength light like blue and violet much more efficiently than long wavelength light like red.
Okay, I'm with you.
So the further away a mountain is, the more atmosphere you're looking through, and the more that scattered blue light reaches your eye. The background mountains look cooler, bluer, lighter, and the contrast in details become incredibly fuzzy. It's called cold atmospheric recession.
Oh, and our brains inherently use that color shift and fuzziness to calculate how far away an object is.
Precisely. But a digital screen doesn't have an atmosphere.
Right.
A monitor displays the pixels of the distant background mountains with the exact same artificial backlight intensity as the pixels of the person standing in the immediate foreground. The screen inherently flattens complex visual perspective into a single, uniform plane of light.
Which is why Duke himself admitted in his own self-critique that he needed to refine the hierarchy of spatial planes to better guide the visual journey.
Exactly.
That specific failure in spatial depth, that flattening of the world, is a direct, undeniable symptom of trusting a flat monitor over human observation.
We've established a pretty severe technical toll here, haven't we? The screen lies about the physics of the light, it pixelates the human dignity out of the crowd, and it flattens the majestic background mountains right into the foreground.
Yeah.
From a purely technical standpoint, it sounds like a recipe for a sterile, disconnected piece of art.
But, and this is the big, but what if it isn't? What if we are looking at this entirely backwards?
Okay, I'm intrigued.
What if this exact same geographic separation, these very technical flaws, are the only way this art could shift into a space of deep emotional synthesis?
Tell me more about that.
I want to talk about the studio as a soundproof booth. Think about what would happen if Duke had packed up his easel and gone down to Columbia to paint this festival on plein air right there in the middle of the plaza.
Oh, man. The sensory assault of reality would be staggering.
Right. The heat is oppressive. It's incredibly loud with the music and the shouting. People are bumping into his easel.
Just chaos.
Total chaos. Someone might literally spill a cup of chicha, like that fermented local drink, right onto his watercolor palette. In that chaotic environment, human nature is to focus on the immediate.
That makes sense.
It is incredibly easy to get completely lost in hyper-realistic details right in front of your nose. You start obsessing over capturing the exact texture of one single broken roof tile or the precise color of one street dog.
You lose the forest for the trees. Or in this case, you lose the emotional resonance of the entire festival for the texture of a single roof tile. You become a human camera, merely documenting the event rather than interpreting it.
Exactly. But the soundproof booth of the Whittier Studio blocks all that chaotic noise. It strips away the overwhelming data.
Right.
And what you are left with isn't a lack of detail. It's the space to actually hear the underlying melody of the culture. You get synthesis.
And, you know, the evidence of this synthesis is right there in his brilliant non-literal color choices.
Yeah.
We talked about the Warren Basilica earlier. But look at the sky he painted.
Yeah, those colors are wild.
He uses these vibrant, almost unnatural orange and blue skies to create what he calls a musical atmosphere. Mm. It's not a literal meteorological sky. It's a sky that feels like a song.
That's beautiful. He also paints the green park not just by matching the green pixels from the photo, but he conceptualizes it as a visual lung.
A visual lung. I mean, it's a stunning way to describe a park in a dense urban painting.
He is intentionally injecting oxygen into the piece. He is painting the concept of breathing space. And that level of poetic interpretation is incredibly difficult to achieve when you are sweating in a crowded plaza trying to match the exact photometric shade of green on a specific leaf.
Yeah, that raises a critical point about the role of memory in creation. When the screen compresses the image and gives you those digital voids, you know, those pixelated, blurry spaces where the camera failed, it is the artist's memory and their deep, intrinsic sense of belonging that steps in to fill in those gaps.
But does this mean nostalgia is just rewriting history? Because if so, maybe it's rewriting it closer to the emotional truth.
It's a fascinating paradox. We really have to ask if nostalgic distance distorts cultural identity, or if it actually clarifies it by removing the mundane distractions.
That's a great way to frame it.
Even if the spatial perspective is flattened by the monitor, those red and terracotta roofs in the painting vibrate with the genuine, remembered warmth of the coffee region's urban fabric.
So by not agonizing over literal photometrics, Duke gets to act like a choreographer, viewing the masses from a balcony high above.
Yes.
He can't paint the calloused hands of three people. True. But a hyper-focused, hyper-realistic portrait of three people doesn't tell you what a festival feels like for an entire town.
A portrait captures the individual, but it often completely misses the kinetic energy of the collective.
Right. By abstracting the crowd from a distance, driven by the limitations of the web photo and the watercolor, he accidentally captures the massive scale, the swirling movement, the true social commitment of thousands of people congregating.
He sacrifices the micro to achieve the macro.
Exactly. The geographic exile, that very separation from his homeland, is the exact thing that allowed her to elevate the town of Sevilla into a cultural symbol, rather than just an architectural study.
It's an incredibly compelling argument for the emotional alchemy of distance. But, you know, it leaves us with a very real, very practical dilemma. Art isn't just theory, it's daily practice. The people listening to this deep dive are creators, thinkers, problem solvers.
So what does this all mean for the creator listening right now? If an art student or a designer or really any creator comes to you and asks, should I go down to the local market and sketch it from life? Or should I take a quick iPhone photo and paint it back in the quiet, temperature-controlled comfort of my dorm room?
Right, the classic question.
What is the actual verdict? How do you practically balance these two warring forces?
Well, it's the ultimate trade-off, and you have to be acutely aware of exactly what you are sacrificing with either choice. Let's break down the mechanics of direct field sketches, plein air painting first.
Okay, let's do it.
When you go to the market and paint from life, you are gaining immediate anthropological empathy.
Meaning you are interacting with the space and the people. You are absorbing the sensory truth.
Exactly. You feel the physical temperature of the shadows, which means your color mixing will be optically true to human vision, not a camera sensor.
Right, because you're seeing subtractive light.
Precisely. And even more importantly, you understand the spatial architecture because your physical body is walking through it. Your brain maps the 3D depth perfectly because you are utilizing stereoscopic vision.
But the danger there, as we establish with the spilled chicha, is the noise.
All the chaos.
Field sketches often lack that broad, unifying narrative energy that comes from stepping back and synthesizing. You might get a beautiful, accurate painting of a single fruit vendor, but completely miss the chaotic, vibrant, overarching energy of the market as a whole.
So then we look at the digital compromise, the dorm room approach. What happens if a student only learns to draw from flat Instagram photos and Pinterest boards?
They lose that structural skeleton entirely, don't they?
Totally. If your artistic diet is exclusively digital screens, your brain never learns to understand true 3D form. You only understand 2D pixels.
Which flattens everything.
Right. Now, web photos and digital references are incredibly useful. They offer massive scale, they freeze complex, fleeting moments in time, and they give you structural proportions that are nearly impossible to map when you are standing right in the middle of a moving crowd.
But there has to be a catch.
The absolute crucial caveat is calibration. Using a screen only works if the artist's eye and brain have been rigorously calibrated by reality first.
Meaning you have to know what the screen is lying to you about before you can use it.
Yes. A loose, abstract watercolor brushstroke designed to define a crowd only works if your brain inherently knows what that low-resolution JPG is failing to show.
Like the callous hands.
Or the hat. You have to know the physical anatomy of the peasant's hat, how the straw weaves together, and how it casts a shadow over the brow, even if you can only see a blurry dark spot on your monitor. The screen should be used to expand your memory and your ability to scale a project, never to replace your fundamental observation of physical reality.
Because if you just blindly trust the screen, you inherit all of its technical flaws.
If you trust those flat pixels too much, your underlying structural architecture will fail. You will lose your atmospheric perspective and your spatial depth. Your background mountains will crash violently into your foreground plaza.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
And if the physical structure of your painting fails, your visual narrative will limp along no matter how deeply emotional, nostalgic, or noble your social intentions are. The nostalgia needs a sturdy, anatomically correct skeleton to hang on to.
So the studio is a safe haven, a soundproof booth, but it shouldn't be an isolation tank.
That's a great way to put it.
You have to bring the rich, complex sensory data you collected in the real world back into that quiet space with you. You synthesize the real world data inside the quiet of the studio, allowing memory to filter out the noise while relying on your calibrated eye to correct the digital lies.
This is why Savion Bandola is such a fascinating case study. It is a true transit piece. It proves that an artist's studio, regardless of its zip code, whether it's in Whittier, California, or anywhere else on the globe, can be an incredible laboratory for cultural synthesis.
Yeah.
It's a place where memory and non-literal color can genuinely pay profound homage to the identity of a distant people.
But it also serves as a stark warning for any creator. It proves that that deep emotional synthesis only happens if the artist actively fights against the flattening, standardizing nature of their digital references.
Yeah.
You have to constantly battle the screen to preserve the depth.
It's a friction we all have to navigate constantly in the modern world. The tools we choose inherently shape the process, and the process inevitably shapes the final truth of the work.
So for everyone listening, take a second today to look around your own workspace. How are your specific tools quietly dictating your output? Are the digital references you use, whether for painting, writing, coding, designing, or anything else, acting as a launchpad that expands your memory and scale? Or are you letting those pixels flatten out your perspective and rob your work of its three-dimensional depth?
We've spent this time analyzing how an artist's brain has to step in and fill the gaps of a low-res digital photo with their own nostalgia and their own emotional truth. But let's apply that to something much closer to home.
Think about your own life for a second. Think about your own deeply held memories. How many of your most cherished, foundational childhood memories are actually genuine, visceral recollections of an event you physically experienced? And how many are just your brain beautifully and seamlessly painting over a blurry photograph you saw in a family album 10 years ago? Are we actually remembering the texture of the event or just remembering the flat picture of the event? It makes you wonder, are we all just sitting in our own mental studios, flattening out our own past. We'll leave you with that to mull over until our next deep dive.